Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. The new Northumberland County Archive and Museum got a big boost last week when it received its first private donation towards its operation. Stuart Richardson, a local businessman, historian, and philanthropist, gave $85,000 towards the main exhibition gallery. It will be named in his honor. In this interview, you will hear from Richardson about his donation. You will also learn about his passion for local history and the many projects, big and small, he has worked on over the years. A lifelong resident of the village of Hastings, he will share memories and stories from the past and present. I am so pleased to have with me today Stuart Richardson, a businessman and philanthropist, and Northumberland County Archive and Museum archivist Abigail Miller. Welcome to you both to Consider This Northumberland.
Hi, thanks, Rob.
Glad to be here.
I want to start with you, Stuart. What made you decide to donate $85,000 towards the new Northumberland County Archive and Museum?
Well, I've always been fascinated in local, and by local, I mean Northumberland County, Indigenous and colonial history. And over the years, I've been into the current archives quite a bit, back and forth, doing some research on a few of the books I worked on, as well as a couple of articles. And so I got to know Abigail and Katie fairly well, and I've seen firsthand the services they provide, not only to people like myself, but also the local historical societies. And when I was talking to them about a year ago, I think now, and I found out they were building a new archives and museum within the confines of the new Golden Plow, that led to more discussions. Just something I believe in. And I thought, oh, what the heck? There's worse ways to spend my money. So I made the commitment to them.
How did you come to the decision? Did you talk with anyone? Did you consult with family? Did you come to it entirely on your own? How did that work?
I had a long talk with my wife, as you could appreciate. We've been involved in a few other philanthropic events or projects. She knows I love history. And when I told her what I was thinking of doing, she supported it. She thought it was a good idea because she's a teacher, she's a retired teacher now. But over the years, she's seen how hard some civil servants work. And as I've said to, Abigail and Katie in the past, part of the reason I'm doing this is because of how hard they work, and I see their commitment to it. So I guess to answer your question, I just went over with my wife and she was supportive of it.
Now, there are lots of historical organizations that you could have donated to. Why specifically an archive and a museum? Why is that particularly of interest?
Well, I'm a member of three historical societies in the county, Hastings, Camelford, and Colburg. But this is a little different. Firstly, those organizations tend to, do okay. I've never been treasurer of any of them, but from what I've seen at annual meetings and that sort of thing, their scope and their objectives are fairly straightforward and small compared to what this new facility is going to be One of the things that really excites me about it, Robert, and I'm sure Abigail will give you better details, is that it's going to be, I guess, what they call a Category A archive and museum. And I had no idea that what this does, and I've had a quick construction tour, so I have a better feel for this now, seeing what they're doing, the HVAC systems and the collection hall. This will allow her team or their team to bring in exhibits from anywhere in the world, if I'm not mistaken. So a year from now, we could be, you know, they can be maybe advertising that come up and see an exhibit from Britain or goodness knows where. And so that really excited me long term.
How did you become interested in history?
Well, I wasn't the strongest student in the world. I went to school at Hastings Public School and then over to Norwood. But history was one of those. My father was in World War II, as was my uncles on both sides of the family. So I kind of grew up with that in the background. I would say that's pretty well it. It was the one subject that I really did well in and have always liked.
Before we go too far, I would like to bring Abigail into the conversation. Abigail, could you give us a synopsis of the events leading up to the creation of this new museum and archive, just for maybe listeners who don't know the background?
Sure. So we really came on board to the Golden Plough Lodge redevelopment project around 2017. And so at that time, you know, plans were being drawn up and, you know, needs assessments were being struck. And at that point, the archives was already full. You know, we were working with very limited space, knowing that we wouldn't be able to collect for very much longer. And so with the redevelopment project kind of already, you know, chugging along, it was seen as an opportunity to join those two projects together. It's a cost-effective approach, and as well, it lends itself to really innovative new opportunities to partner with the Golden Plough Lodge, offer intergenerational programming between our institutions. You know, it's very unique for the residents of the home to be able to be so close to a cultural hub. And so, you know, we can... the two things really actually work very well together, even though, you know, up front, it's kind of like, oh, that's a curious thing to have an archives and museum with a long-term care facility. But we're excited for the different opportunities that will come from it. And so, yeah, it was really from that, just the need for a place to properly exhibit our collection, store our collection, and make the materials available to the public in a facility that's, you know, properly climate controlled and has the space to do that safely.
Can you remind us of the date for the opening?
Oh, we don't have an exact date yet. We will be excited to put that out in the public as soon as we know. The facility is still under construction. And so there are many things to happen before, you know, we can open to the public. So we need to get the collection in there. We're also going to be installing the new inaugural exhibition. And so there's many little cogs kind of working at the same time. And so we are hopeful that we'll be in by the end of September. But certainly, you know, by the end of, you know, the fall this year, I don't want to make any real promises, but, you know, we're remaining flexible, basically, Rob, but we'll let you know the date as soon as we know it.
I understand there's going to be a special event for the opening. For those listeners who may not be familiar, can you explain what that is? Because it's kind of interesting.
Sure. So our inaugural exhibition is called Gadina Wendeman, and it means all our relations. And so it's an exhibition that celebrates Mishisagig, the local dialect of Anishinaabemowin. And so this exhibition is one that has been, we've been planning this since 2019, actually. It's got long legs as well. It's being led by a group of Indigenous advisors, really, who are just powerhouses in language revitalization work. And so they've been leading this all along the way. And so that's going to be, you know, our big splash to the community. And so we'll at once have a grand opening just to show off the whole space. But this new exhibition is going to be something that's going to draw people from all over the place, because it's something that is just, it's featuring the artwork of James Monkman. He's a digital artist, and it's so contemporary, and it just connects really with the heart of the language. And you can tell like how much thought has gone into it from the people involved. And so we're really excited to be able to launch with those two components.
How did you learn about this donation?
If I may, Stuart had come into the archives and had just very subtly stated that someone was interested in supporting us, and would we set up a meeting to kind of discuss that further. And Katie and I were both like, yes, of course, that sounds wonderful. You know, love to discuss anyone who values what we do and wants to support it. And at the time, Stuart didn't say that it was him. In fact, that was actually, looking to donate. But yeah, during that second meeting, he kind of came clean and said, look, the donor's me. So, you know, how do we make this happen? And of course, from there, you know, we got the ball rolling, and of course, we're going to try and find any way to make the donation process as easy as possible.
How is this donation significant from your perspective?
Multiple ways. I mean, first of all, just the fact that anybody, is willing to put up their own private money towards of supporting the Archives and Museum, that means a lot to us. It shows that, you know, this is valued in the community, and that we are serving the people that we really want to. The Archives and Museum is here to be a resource for the community, and to see the community kind of reflect that back to us and appreciate it, it means so much. And of course, you know, $85,000 is a significant amount of money, and that we are able to put it directly into the development of this exhibition is huge. This project has been a reconciliation project from the beginning. But it's certainly one that is far beyond anything that the county's done on this scale to put up the staff resources and the monetary resources towards it. Because we're doing it at such a grand scale, we need the support of everyone we can. And so that makes it a special as well.
It is my understanding that it is part of a larger fundraising campaign with a goal of $300,000. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's right. So, so far the exhibition has been supported by Canadian Heritage. Funded partially by the Government of Canada. Cameco has also provided a generous donation, and then Stuart's contribution has all gone towards that. But overall, there is still a $300,000 gap that we would be looking to in order to fund some of the AV equipment, the traveling components, and just the artist's work that is going toward this project. And so that's basically where that money would go.
Stuart, I'd like to come back to you for a moment. You were born and raised in Hastings. What was the village of Hastings like when you were a kid?
You know, it was really idyllic because almost right out of a movie. There was a. We went to the Hastings Public School. Back then, there was a Catholic school, and we went to the United Church. I say we, my wife and I, and everybody, you know, a lot of the other kids went to the Catholic Church. So there was a. I say that because it was a real thing back then. But then once you all start playing sports and get a little older, then it all goes away and you all become great friends. It was a great place to live. My dad ran the liquor store for 38 years. My mother was a registered nurse in Camelford Hospital. And they worked hard. I have three older sisters. I was the youngest. And for me, it was a great spot. I mean, I was active in sports, and when back then we went to Norwood High School. During my time in high school, the younger kids coming into grade 9 started to go to Calmerford then. That's why now all the kids in Hastings go to Calmerford. But back then we went to Norwood, and we used to call it Snorwood High, but it was a great high school too. Small teachers all came from Peterborough more or less and would commute in every day, but no, life was good. Looking back on it, I mean, I think what I liked, looking back on it, what I got from it the most are all our neighbors. We lived on the road over towards leaving town towards Norwood, and some of our neighbors were not as lucky as our family. I grew up with those kids, and it was just really, it was good, a lot of good life lessons looking back on it. So, and being one of the most beautiful villages, I think, in Ontario, on the Trent River there back then. Tremendous amount of people from Ohio would come up in the summer. So it was a real tourist town as well, more so than it is now. But long answer, but it was a great spot to grow up.
You certainly had an interesting childhood. Can you tell us the story of the bank robbery?
Yeah. When I was 4, my mother took me down to downtown. My sisters were all at school, and I guess put her check in the bank with my father's. It was a Wednesday, I believe, because the liquor store was closed. When we walked in, it was just my mom and I, and one other person to our right. And next thing you know, 3 guys come in and locked the door behind her and yelled out that the bank is being robbed, and brought the manager out. And I know all this through my mother in articles I've read. I do remember actually someone with a stocking on their face. It's the only memory I have of. Oh, and I also have a memory of my mother running to lock the door after they left so they wouldn't get back in. And so not about 10 years ago, I decided just to write a little story, and they published it in the Trent Valley Gazette there in Peterborough. It was a fascinating story because it was the biggest news in the village for years, as you could appreciate. There's a lot of side stories to it and humor. For example, when mom ran to the door and yelled out, "The bank's been robbed," she was yelling across the street at Jim Blackburn, who was working cleaning a manhole cover. Well, Jim was also the police constable. So he threw the shovel at the car as they roared by him, heading south across the bridge. And that was lampooned in the Toronto Star. It shows a picture. I still have the Toronto Star. It shows a picture of a policeman kind of dressed in with a hat, but also his workman clothing, throwing a shovel at a car as it sped away. So anyway, it was a good story.
After you left school, you've ended up becoming a very successful businessman. Can you tell us about that journey and how that acumen of business has played into your life?
Well, after high school, I went out west like everybody else did back then, and then that didn't work out. So I came home and realized I needed to further my education. I didn't qualify for university because I didn't finish grade 13. I decided to go out west. But I did qualify for back then community college. So I took a course at Loyalist, a 2-year course in social work of all things, not in business. But that led to a summer job at Manpower, if you remember Manpower, where people would go to get a summer job or get a job. And the fellow that I worked with there, we got along. He was a permanent employee. I was just a summer one. We got along quite well. At the end of the summer, he said, what are you doing this fall? And I said, nothing. I'm going to go to Toronto and look for work. And he said, well, we have this extra money left over. We're looking for, you know, it's a local business type thing. Have you ever thought of doing your own business? Well, a friend of mine in Marmara and I put together a business plan for a business in, oddly enough, repairing wooden pallets, which is real sexy, and firewood. And the program was called LEAP, Local Economic Assistance Program. You know, it was notoriously not corrupt, but a lot of failed and misguided money went into it. I'm pleased to say we started that business and it lasted for 28 years. It was one of the few lead projects that ever lasted more than 3 years because we weren't making canoes or candles or anything too artsy. It was just pretty straightforward. So that's how I got into business. And, but I had that social work, you know, thing going on too, because we had to hire young unemployable kids. And of course, back then, Marmon was full of them. And, so that's how I got into the wood pallet business. And then I worked for a company in Tweed, which is still there. And then I started my own business. And I worked for a trade association, a pallet association, and then eventually went back into the business myself and had plants in Etobicoke and Whitby. And at one point, I had 140 people working for me. So just goes to show you, and I say this to my own children, don't worry about what room you're going to get into. Just get into a house, something you enjoy doing, and then you'll eventually, hopefully, find your way.
You've done many philanthropic things over time. And one of the bigger projects you helped raise money for was Ed's House, hospice which is located just north of Coburg. Can you share how you became interested in this particular project?
Well, if there's anything I'm proud of, and I hope this doesn't sound boastful, here it does, but anyway, what the heck. My wife's father passed away at home, and it was not easy on the girls and the brother. That was his wish, and they honored his wish. Then it was all over with. I was aware of the hospice in Warkworth, the bridge. And I dropped in to see them, and then I went to see Rhonda Cunningham at the hospital here in Coburg. And I said, Rhonda, why don't we have a hospice in Coburg? And she said, well, there's always been a strong hospice movement here through Community Care Northumberland, but they've just never been able to get to first base with an actual hospice. And this is, I think, in 2016 or 17 now, holy smokes. She said, I should really go visit Trish Baird at Community Care Northumberland, who I'm sure you know. And Trish is in Camelford. So I went up to see Trish. And I told her this is something I would commit to time-wise, because I had just sold my companies. And as you know, your energy just doesn't go away overnight. So I met with their board, and my wife Nancy and I agreed to fund a feasibility study. And what they do with these major fundraising projects, they bring in these companies who will go out into the countryside or whatever area and determine if the community will support it. They did that. That was about, I think it was a $35,000 donation, which we gave to our Community Care Northumberland. They came back and said, yes, they would do this. The community needs a hospice and there's enough money to do this. So we formed we formed the building committee before we formed the campaign committee. We started looking for land. And so, but then we formed a building committee officially and then a campaign committee. I had no experience in campaign committee, so we were lucky to get Gordon Patty Lay to chair that. And most importantly, we were able to get Linda Kay, who had just retired from the Northumberland United Way, to come on as our fundraiser. So, my accountant at the time told me he would match whatever I donated. So Nancy and I donated $250,000 and my accountant matched it. So you can imagine Robert and Abigail starting a project with $500,000 in the way. And we made this commitment to community care. Well, what I've learned about fundraising is there's two sides to it. Sometimes people wonder, why do you show how much you donated in your name to it? Well, I found out from these professionals that were helping us now is that that's the best way to do it, because I struggled with this with Abigail's donation. I did not care if they used my name at this stage, but so they put your name up. So suddenly we had momentum. We had momentum with $500,000 and then with a strong campaign committee and a really hardworking building committee. Let me tell you, they did a lot of work. Some wonderful people on that building committee. We started the process. We visited 12 different hospices to determine best practices, both in the physical design of the building And also, in of course, what are they doing that's best for the patients and their families? So I must say, I've never been involved in with a group or a project in my life that was so fulfilling. We were so lucky. It just seemed every time we'd hit a roadblock, something would come along. And like, for a small example, they don't extend the water into Hamilton Township anymore. And there's always been this thing, yet we were able to extend the water about 100 yards. Obviously, it was a good cause, but still, there's a lot of politics between Goldberg and Hamilton Township. Great councils at the time. Then of all things, along comes COVID. But we were able to finish the project with Dalrymple on time and on budget when everything else was going through the roof. So again, I just can't thank the committees and the people that were involved in that and the many donators who came out of the woodwork to get us up to the $10 million we needed. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I have nothing to do with it now. My wife, Nancy, is a strong volunteer there on the garden and on the front desk. But if I'm not mistaken, I think over 300 families or individuals, of course, have used the services of Ed's House since it's been built. And I think it provides a much needed service in our great community.
What's next for you on the horizon?
Well, nothing. Seriously, this project with Abigail and Katie is easy. I mean, I joked to someone the other day. They were saying, "Well, good for you," and I said, "Yeah, but the check bounced." That's a joke, by the way. Sorry, Abigail, but now this is the way it should be. Easy. And I just enjoy, you know, I'm part of the historical societies and the Trent Hills Sports Wall of Honor group there. That's enough. That's fun. And I'm also, I should mention, I'm on the board of directors of the Calniford Seymour Northumberland Foundation, which is a great organization. And it's just picking up steam here in South Northumberland. And I think that's got a lot of potential long term for the community.
Abigail, what's next for the archive and museum?
Well, what's next is us moving our collection up to close to 555 Courthouse Road. We do have a new mailing address at this new site, and that is really taking up a lot of our focus now. But of course, we're always looking ahead and just being open to the public and being able to stop talking about, you know, when we're open, we look forward to inviting you in and all of that stuff. Actually just being open and having a proper space to welcome people in and just like do the work that, you know, that we love to do. That's really what's next. But, you know, we're going to have this exhibition in for 9 months. And then from there, we've got an open gallery that will be programming it with all kinds of different things. And so, you know, we're already looking ahead to plan, you know, the next use of this great new space. And so, yeah, there's so many things on the horizon. But yeah, for now, we're just so happy and pleased to be having the privilege and opportunity to move into this beautiful new space and have the support of community members like Stuart. And so we really can't ask for anything more. Other than, of course, anyone else who's generous and looking to support something like this, there's plenty of opportunity for that.
Robert, could I speak to Abigail's last comment there about looking for other people?
Go ahead.
The same accountant that helped me or helped us get the Ed's House going with his generous donations has a great saying, and it goes, "It's better to give with a warm hand than a cold one." And I had never heard that before. And I love old sayings. And I think it's appropriate here that if someone's listening and there's many things they can donate to in our great county, but if this interests them, I'd recommend they reach out to Abigail and Katie, because you can't take it with you, right?
Stuart Richardson, Abigail Miller, I want to thank you both for talking to me today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Robert.
That was Stuart Richardson, businessman and philanthropist, and Northumberland County Archive and Museum archivist Abigail Miller. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.